From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? You really want to do that and find out about my carnivore highs and lows, as well as seeing what delicious meats I have hauled home this week. Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's extraordinary woman is Beck Johnson. Beck is the CEO of the Type 1 Diabetes Family Centre in Western Australia, an Australia first centre for people with type 1 diabetes. Diagnosed with type 1 in 2001, Beck believes that there are no limits on a life with type 1 diabetes, and she has twice swum solo across the 20-kilometre Rottnest Channel, sailed across the Atlantic, and become a scuba dive guide to prove it. She manages her type 1 with multiple daily injections, a low-carbohydrate diet, frequent connection with the type 1 tribe, and plenty of active living. Beck holds qualifications in law and arts, a master's in public health, and a diploma of business. She is an adjunct research fellow at Curtin University, a fellow of the Australian Institute of Community Directors, and a fellow of Leadership WA. She is the only Australian to have been selected as one of the 100 fellows of the Global Facebook Community Leadership Programme. Beck is the last of my Type 1 interviews from Low Carb Denver. Like Tracy from last week, Beck and I have been trying to coordinate recording an episode for a while, so it was great that we never managed it remotely, but rather got to meet and chat across from one another instead. I learned so much from Beck and the other women I interviewed about type 1 diabetes, as well as presentations at the conference. Off sidelines in discussions by type 2, type 1 diabetes seems to be an area where eating low carb is just as important and garners equally impressive results. I am, as always, in awe of the extraordinary people I meet and am fortunate enough to chat with so that I can share those conversations with you. Beck is no exception, and I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I hope you do too. Welcome back to the Keto Woman Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. Thank you, Daisy. Thanks for having me.
Loving the conference?
Oh, it's awesome. I'm learning so, so much. Brain is full.
Mine too. It feels like there's a little bit of space there left to maybe squeeze some more knowledge in. But we were just saying earlier before we started, I sometimes feel have this sort of limit to how much you can stuff in a limited period of time. But you made the comment, and I think that's absolutely true, that they've got a really nice pace with different presentations going on that just stops you having that overload effect.
Yeah, I agree. I think that they've balanced the high-level public health content with the getting down into the weeds with the technical stuff really well. So you can come through a technical presentation and just have a little bit of a break and zoom out and take on something that's a bit more big picture. And I really like the way they've balanced that.
Yeah, me too. So tell us a bit about you.
I am 35 years old. I've had type 1 diabetes since I was 17. I've been eating low carb for about 17 and a half years. So 7 or 8 months post-diagnosis, I switched to a low carb diet and have been keto since about 2012, when I started experimenting with a ketogenic approach for endurance exercise. I'm also the CEO and one of the founders of the Type 1 Diabetes Family Centre in Perth in Western Australia. And that's a facility and service of which I'm immensely proud. We're now supporting more than 1,000 people impacted by type 1 diabetes in our state. And we very much have an holistic and food first approach to diabetes management, encompassing not only nutrition, certainly, but insulin therapy, being versed up on all the tools, the technical tools and devices that you can use to manage diabetes, but also mental wellness, peer support, and very much that wraparound social support element that I think is needed for a life well lived with a chronic disease like diabetes.
I think it's really important to take that holistic approach.
Absolutely. And I think that we've had a very medical model of care for type 1 diabetes that's really focused on insulin therapy and insulin delivery devices. And I feel that zooming out and looking at all the different pillars of good diabetes care and good health, nutrition, exercise, mental support, and indeed family support. That's why we called ourselves the Type 1 Diabetes Family Centre. As far as I'm concerned, type 1 diabetes is a team sport. Every person in a family is impacted by a diagnosis, and every person needs to be knowledgeable, compassionate to the person living with diabetes, but also to themselves, because it is a long journey and it can go in a lot of different directions. And the Family Centre is there to help people through that.
And it's great, this working together with the patient and their family, which is really important, but with the medical care they're getting. I was talking to Belinda Lennertz earlier, and she was saying that there's often this mismatch between the patient and the practitioner they're working with, and that they're quite often feeling really alone because they're going out on a bit of a limb, getting involved in this way of eating, and they're not feeling supported. So it's really nice to hear that they're are more practices, at least embracing this approach, even if they can't necessarily promote it. But it sounds like you're able to take it more to that level, to actually promote it and suggest it as a way of eating and a lifestyle to adopt that's really going to help manage the lifestyle for the type 1 diabetic in question.
Yes, we are. We believe that a low carbohydrate approach should be on the table as one of the first line therapies in relation to type 1 diabetes management. Obviously, it's always going to be adjunct to good insulin therapy. However, we're not afraid to talk about it. We feel that it is not that controversial. It's just eating real food. And it is certainly central to our approach to care. If patients want to come in and talk about it, then we'll have the conversation, because at the Family Centre, we believe that people with type 1 should be supported to transition to or maintain a low carbohydrate approach with solid dietetic support. They need to be meeting their micronutrients. They need to be meeting their energy requirements. And I think that not everybody does it well alone. And if we're able to provide them that clinical support, then that's what we're here to do. We are not necessarily leading with it. We lead with the holistic approach that I think the patient-centered approach is really what we're about, in that when patients come into the family center, the first question they're asked is, what are your goals? And we really work with those, because if somebody comes in and HbA1c isn't their goal and it's not their focus, but perhaps weight management or exercise or managing hypos is, then we've got to go in building a relationship on what they need, rather than necessarily going away and saying, well, HbA1c is the marker of good diabetes management. That doesn't necessarily serve them. So that's what we do.
And what are the most common concerns that people have when they come to you? The primary concerns, the things that are impacting their lives in the most negative way that they're trying to fix or find strategies to help. You know, what are the most common problems that people are asking for help for?
In relation to diet and type 1 diabetes, or more generally?
I suppose just in generally, because you take that holistic approach in just managing their type 1 diabetes, what are the biggest issues that they have that really impact living a quote-unquote normal life?
Before we opened the family center, we ran a whole series of focus groups asking parents of kids with type 1 and adolescents and young people with type 1 what they needed. And the theme that came through most strongly was connection. They said to us, we feel isolated. We feel alone. We feel unsupported and underserved by not only the medical community, but by the community at large. People don't understand our disease. It's invisible, which is in some ways a blessing and in some ways a curse, because the general community doesn't see it, doesn't understand it. And the power of connection is transformative. And that's why we have very much led with a peer support approach. We've set up online communities that are thriving with parents of kids with type 1 and now adults. And they're running through closed Facebook groups. And as you'll know, as someone participating in the social media world with in relation to keto and this way of eating, it's just a live, dynamic community. And so we've set those up. We have hundreds of engagements every day through our online communities, and we also have a lot of face-to-face connection and events. So that's how we have tried to build a community in Western Australia around people with type 1, because we want to make sure that people don't have to live that lonely road, and that they can feel connected. And I think the value of connection is not only in the sense of not feeling isolated and alone, it's also the information exchange that happens when you're part of a bigger community, the hive brain that you can tap into of hundreds of people that have experienced what you're experiencing and can offer insight and advice and knowledge. I think there's huge value in that as well.
Yes, that's a really big difference, isn't it? I can remember when I had my first weight loss surgery and I was just completely isolated and just wasn't getting good information from the bariatric team. And just, there was just nowhere to access the information until I started finding online groups, you know, and that surgery didn't go well. But when I had the revision surgery, I had access to all these online groups, and the difference was incredible. Being able to make contact with people who are going through, have been through the same thing, is just worlds apart from dealing with the theory of it from someone who hasn't experienced it. It's just so much more reassuring to be able to talk to your peers in that situation, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And we've made that central to the philosophy at the Family Centre, in that nearly every member of our team is personally impacted by type 1. So it goes all the way through to the people. I truly believe that people with type 1 diabetes should be working in diabetes organizations, because there is that sense of, again, connection. You can drop your shoulders when you walk into the family center, because everybody there gets it. And that ocean deep compassion, that's the stuff. That's the stuff that changes the trajectory of people's type 1 diabetes management, that helps them come to terms with it, to make peace with it, because they see others who are living with it and working well with it. And I think that's what we aim to create.
I'd be really interested to hear more about your personal experience about when you got your diagnosis. What led up to that? What led up to you? You know, you obviously realized that something was going wrong. There was a problem, but I'd just be interested to hear more about that.
It was interesting. It came off the back of a very, very stressful year. I'd finished my final year exams and I was the goody two shoes overachiever at high school who was the captain of everything. And I believe that maybe that lead in of that sort of 8 to 12 months of high stress in my final year at school was possibly one of the triggers of my diabetes diagnosis, which was in April the following year. So I got really unwell over a series of, you know, short months and lost a lot of weight. I think I lost 12, 14 kilos over a couple of months. The thirst is just indescribable. And I remember I would wake up through the night and probably I drank the worst thing I possibly could have drank. I couldn't even go near a glass of it today. And that was apple and guava juice. I went through liters of the stuff. And, indeed, I remember it being at a wedding. And that night I was so thirsty. I drank 5 carafes of lemonade. I mean, and I remember the fella I was with was thinking, what is wrong with this girl? And I was just making my sugar level higher and higher and higher and getting thirstier and thirstier. I had every symptom in the book, blurry vision, sores that wouldn't heal, leg cramps. And finally, my mum dragged me to the doctor. She had made several appointments for me, which I had cancelled because I hate going to the doctor. And I went to see my GP who did a finger stick and he did a blood draw and I got a phone call the next day and I'll never forget his voice. He said, Rebecca, you have diabetes. And it was this very final sentence and my heart sank. I didn't really know what that meant, but I knew it was bad. And he basically said, get to the hospital ASAP. And I went there and I was diagnosed and it was just this whirlwind of 3 to 4 days. I was admitted. I was given my first insulin injection, which made me feel instantly better, which was wonderful. But then I was given the education and I will never forget again. They brought in an orange and a needle and they made me practice learning how to inject with the orange because it's the same sort of texture as flesh apparently. So I injected a number of times and then they gave me a fresh needle and said, okay, now it's your turn. And that was it. That was the start of 5 to 7 injections of insulin every day. I think on calculation, I've probably had around 45,000 injections in my life. It was the start of 8 to 10 blood glucose finger pricks every day. And it was the beginning of the counting, the endless counting of carbohydrates, fats, and proteins, plugging that into complex insulin to carbohydrate ratios, which change in my body 4 to 5 times a day. The string theory that you have to do to manage insulin dose calculations. And I guess the beginning of that fear, which lasted in a very intense way for the first 8 months of administering a hormone that is so powerful, it will kill me if I get the dose wrong, in what back then was in really quite large amounts and had me afraid to take a walk around the block.
That's incredible, man.
Or go to sleep or any of those things that a normal life we should be able to do without thinking. And that was the beginning of my journey towards finding a solution.
Yeah. So what advice were you given when it comes to diet?
Eat according to the Australian Guide to Healthy Eating, which was, you know, 8 to 12 serves of starchy vegetables and grain-based carbohydrates every day, limit fat, lots of fruit. And I dutifully did that for the first 8 months. It was cereal and toast for breakfast. I had sandwiches for lunch. I had fruit for snacks. I had pasta for dinner. And every meal, my blood glucose surged high and then crashed low because insulin is a woefully blunt tool, synthetic insulin in any case. it is not even close to the sensitivity of a physiological insulin response. So I was trying to deal with these tsunamis of glucose charging into my system with, you know, great big wads of exogenously delivered artificial insulin and a whole lot of guesswork.
That's what strikes me, that the calculations are just fraught with danger because they can only be guesstimates at best.
They are. And I think that we're given this advice as people with type 1 that here is this thing called the insulin to carbohydrate ratio. And if you count your carbs accurately and you weigh them and you do the ratio, then your dose is going to be good. And I really genuinely think that many members of the medical profession believe that works. It's not sound science. It's much more art than it is science, because there are so many factors that influence not only the carbohydrates and the rate at which they're absorbed into our system, but also how fast insulin is absorbed. I know from years of practice that if I put my needle in my stomach, it's going to work a lot faster than if I put it into my arm. And if I put it into my bum, it's going to work in a different way altogether. And so even just the basic where you put your needle in is going to impact how fast the insulin works. And then there are myriad other factors around absorption of tissues at the site, you know, how active you've been. I think wonderful Adam Brown has isolated 42 factors that impact blood glucose, and a lot of them are food and obviously insulin related. But it is just such a complex beast. And the advice that you're given that here's the formula, go forth and conquer, it just falls flat. And yet I think so many people, it raises this false hope that we've got a tool, we have a formula, and it just doesn't work like that.
Mm. There are just variables at every level, every turn, but yet you're being told that this is quite an accurate linear equation that you should be able to master.
Mm.
So if things aren't going quite right, which I imagine is probably the norm, or certainly are not going right all the time, the logical conclusion of that is, well, I must be doing it wrong.
Absolutely. And there, I think the feeling of I am a failure is a very familiar feeling for people with type 1, because, you know, we're set up to hope and believe that with the formulas and with the counting, you know, we've got this control over diabetes, and that doesn't work. And then when we go in to see practitioners around it who aren't compassionate to the daily experience of living with type 1, it can feel like you're a naughty kid being dragged in front of the principal. You know, I remember going in to see my endocrinologist, and he would flip through my book. You know, there's apps for this stuff now, but I used to write down all my blood sugar levels, and I might have fantastic control for weeks, but then he'd flip back and he'd point to the hypo that I had on the 7th of April, which was months before, and he said, "What happened here?" And the whole appointment many times would zero in on something that went wrong and reverse engineering that. And so there is never a sense, there wasn't in my experience, there wasn't a sense of congratulating me or celebrating me for the things I did right. It was more around, okay, how do we hone in on the risks and the stuff that I didn't do right? And I think that the hard thing about type 1 is that it's all on me. All of those calculations, all of the discipline around food, around exercise, around managing those myriad factors, it's all on me to manage. There is no other thing I can blame. And so when it goes wrong, it does feel like my fault. And that can be a really hard thing to deal with. And learning more recently around self-compassion, and building that resilience and compassionate self-talk and behavior has been a really important piece for me and a relatively new thing. But we have to be compassionate to ourselves, because there's a lot of management that goes into diabetes. At any given moment, 25% of my brain space is taken up with calculations.
Yeah. Got to allow some room for other things.
Mm.
What triggered led you to start looking for something else, a different way of managing all this?
There wasn't a particular incident. I just woke up one morning and said, I can't live like this. I've had enough. There has to be another way. And I think I went on, it wasn't Google then, I went online and found the Dr. Bernstein's diabetes solution. I wish I could remember the search terms that I plugged in to find that, but I saved up. I was working in a video store as a student at the time and I was earning about $11 an hour, and I had to save up, I think it was about $68 to buy this book and pay for the shipping, and it took weeks to come from America. There was no Amazon or book depository then, and I read it, I devoured it, and it made so much sense. Indeed, I had already been restricting carbohydrate in the lead-in to getting this book because I just couldn't cope with the feeling of my high blood sugar. And then reading that was very much validation. So I took those high-level principles, felt much more confident about it, and implemented it them into my life. And almost immediately, everything changed. My insulin doses dropped by 75%. And they still remain very, very low. So my error margins dropped significantly because I wasn't dosing myself with industrial doses of insulin anymore. My hypos became mild instead of completely brain frying, you know, shaking, sweating, terrifying things. And everything became so much easier. My roller coaster blood glucose levels smoothed out, and I have maintained that way of eating with a few blips, admittedly, for the last 17 and a half years, and maintained A1Cs in the low fives and high fours. I think my highest A1C ever was 6.6 for the majority of that time. It has completely changed my trajectory with this disease and my ability to live a rich and full and active life with it.
Yeah, I mean, I can just sense that switch from despair and I just can't do this anymore to one of hope and potential of happiness and normality.
Absolutely. And people say, oh, wow, but isn't eating low carb hard? I think it might take a bit of discipline. I find it extremely easy now, and a bit of creativity in the kitchen.
To start with.
Yeah, I agree. It takes, you know, build your knowledge base, get committed, be disciplined around navigating your food choices, and, you know, you get creative, although it's getting easier and easier now. It wasn't easy then because there were no low-carb conversations happening. I was very much out in the wild. But it is something that we can do and we can thrive with. And you're absolutely right. Once you have that foundation and that base laid around the confidence and the skills to eat low carb and navigate food, then it becomes so much easier and life does feel more hopeful.
And I was at a party last night and Pamela Zorn had laid out wonderful array of food. And we were just laughing, you know, joking, saying, oh, you know, this way of eating is so onerous. There were two or three different kinds of crackers. There was a delicious smoked salmon dip. She'd made cultured butter, cultured truffle butter, poppers, prime ribs, smoked chicken. It's like, oh, you know.
Where was my invitation? This sounds sensational.
This is so hard. Mm. How can anyone think eating that is onerous in any way?
And yes.
Yeah, you know, the transition is difficult because apart from anything else, you know, most people are just fighting that carb addiction. But once you're through that, and you can just revel in so many things that we've been told for so long are bad because they're full of fat, you know, but they're delicious.
Yes.
But you're a swimmer, competitive swimmer.
That's right.
Tell us about that and how that all, the implications of that with the type 1.
I love swimming. I've been a swimmer since I was a kid. And I'll dial back a little bit into sort of transitioning across into keto because it has been – I had to take a long hiatus from swimming until I really got keto right because for various reasons there were technical difficulties around testing my blood glucose in the water, but also the transition across to keto in 2012 was around endurance exercise generally. I was doing long distance mountain bike racing at that point and triathlon, and the conversation around ketogenic diets and becoming fat adapted adapted, sort of came across my radar with Steve Finney's and Jeff Volek's book, The Art and Science of Low Carbohydrate Performance. And that really changed my thinking around how I could become a better endurance athlete by becoming completely fat adapted. At that point, I'd probably been low carb and eating above the keto threshold. When I read that book, I dropped my carbohydrate considerably and changed my macronutrient ratio and found myself racing around mountain bike courses with a big smile on my face and endless energy. And that really helped me feel safe and confident to come back to swimming, because I felt, having watched my blood glucose stay completely stable while I raced and trained on land, I felt confident that I could get back in the water. And at that point, because I was not able to test my blood, I could still trust that it was going to stay stable. So that was really the push that I needed and certainly wanted to be able to get back into swimming. And I have since gone on and done the Rottnest Channel swim twice now, which is a 20-kilometer swim to an island off Perth. We've got a few big plans to do a double crossing next year, so that would be a pretty major achievement that I really love to tackle. But we do a huge amount of training, so squad sessions, sessions in the river, sessions in the ocean every week in the lead up to these races. And yeah, fueling it with a ketogenic approach. It's quite remarkable when I see my swimming friends who are taking on carbohydrates every 20 minutes while we're training, and gel shots, and we're having to drop drink bottles with Powerade up and down the beach when we do our long sets. And they all remark, you know, how do you do this without any fuel? And I was like, you know, I got enough fuel in my left bum cheek to swim to Madagascar, you know, like, and it feels wonderful and very freeing to not only be able to feel like I have an endless source of slow burn energy, not have to eat, because eating while swimming, I don't know if you've ever tried it. It's not an easy thing to do.
I can't imagine it would be, no.
When you've got a salty tongue and you're trying to ingest something while you're treading water because you're not allowed to hang on to a boat, that's against the race rules. It's not a fun thing, you know, and I've got mates that eat peanut butter sandwiches and all sorts of ridiculous things out there, and I'm there going, I'd rather just keep swimming, thanks. But also finally to trust that I can, my blood glucose is going to stay stable. That's the holy grail of exercise formulas for someone with type 1. So it's something that ketogenic diet has very much enabled me to do and to do well, which I'm really happy about.
Well, I can always remember my mum used to drum into me, I wasn't allowed to swim until at least an hour after I'd eaten. So I think I'd constantly have that voice in my head. Well, you can't possibly eat and be swimming at the same time.
Yeah. That's it. You'd have to take a little rest, a siesta floating on your back. I don't actually understand. Don't know where that advice comes from.
I don't know where that's come from either. Mm. But it was just something that was like this really strict rule.
Yeah, I'd had that too as a kid. So I don't know about that.
Presumably then you must have seen quite a difference with the practicalities of how you were organizing that your swim before and after keto. It sounds like you're not having to take on any fuel at all, you know, in the competition swimming, or do you have to take on some?
I could very easily do it completely fasted. I guess the only reason why I would refuel during a long race is if I get a bit hungry or to lift my spirit, because if you face down in murky green water for hours and hours and end with no one to talk to and just inside your own head, sometimes it's nice to take a break, and having something nice to eat is, or take on board, is just something to do, I think. The other reason why I might take some nutrition in is to keep me warm, and that does actually really help. Yeah, there's no real need for it. I can run on ketones and feel like I've got perfectly stable energy levels throughout long
swims.
But you
did need it before, pre-keto, when you were doing it.
Pre-keto, I was doing a little bit of swimming, but I think that at that point I had a lot less knowledge and the skills weren't there in relation to how do I manage diabetes, and I wasn't doing particularly well, which made me sort of avoid swimming to a certain extent. The testing regimen was a lot more onerous. Now I wear a Freestyle Libre, which is the little sensor. I can put the receiver in a waterproof phone bag and just scan myself in the water, so I'm totally self-sufficient. Then I'd have to stop and dry my fingers and get warm and test my blood. And it was just fairly onerous to do. So I think that sort of that combination of the technology and the ketogenic approach has really just allowed me to do swimming with the freedom that I want to do it with, without having to constantly think about or be anxious about blood sugar levels and how I'm going to test them next.
I remember Richard Morris telling me about the practicalities. You have to have the insulin you potentially need floating out there, accessible for you to use when you need it.
Yes. So when I race, I have a paddler, a support paddler, and he would have my hydration, nutrition, insulin, all pre-prepped, my glucose monitor in the Libre. And when we stop to do a blood sugar test, he will throw me the Libre. I can't touch the boat. I've got a tread water scan. If I need insulin, he's got the pens. He has to throw that to me. It's got a float on it so that it doesn't sink, because I can't even be past something, because that would be a disqualification. I have practiced treading water and injecting insulin. It's not as difficult as you might think, with a pen in particular. And yeah, so all of those transitions have to be practiced before race day to make sure that we're doing it right. I'm not going to be disqualified and I can do all the diabetes management tasks that I need to do.
What's the distance? How long are we talking about with these races and the time that it takes?
We would do 10-kilometre swims regularly on the weekends, and the distance for the race, this recent one's 19.7 kilometres. So what's that, about 12 and a half miles, I think?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
The first time I did it was horrific. It took nearly 10 hours. I got stuck in a horrible current and I swam over the same rock for about 2 hours at one point. I think it was soul destroying.
I was going to say, that sounds like the ultimate
it
in
was
frustration.
Awful. And I was seasick, and I didn't know that I got seasick until about 10Ks in, when I started being sick and my heart just sank, because I thought, oh my gosh, I've got a long way to go. If the only thing that's going to fix me at this point, because I can't keep anything down, is being on land, and I have 10 kilometres to swim. So that took me 6 hours, that last 10Ks of that race, because of the current issue and because I had to stop every 15 minutes to puke. But if not for keto at that point, if I had been a carb-dependent athlete and I needed to have nutrition going in every 15 or 20 minutes, that would have been my swim over. You know, and I'd trained for 6 months for this race, but the fact that I didn't have to take anything on board as I was being sick, that was something that I was thinking, far out, I'm so glad that I've adapted to this approach, because I just don't need to have the fuel. It's awful vomiting, but I can get through that. The second time I did it, which was last week, it took me 7 hours. So I took 3 hours off my PB, which I'm really happy with. You don't do that every day. And it was a brilliant swim. I had a great time. I had a tiny little bit too much long-acting insulin on board, which I started to really wear in the last couple of hours of the race. So I did need to take some glucose on to counteract that. But again, first 14Ks was a breeze. I had half a YoPro yogurt, which was 3 grams of carbs, just so that I could take some medication on board at the 10K mark, some more seasickness tablets. and that was all I would have needed if not for that tiny little bit too much insulin. So felt a lot better through that race.
So you're out there, apart from your support team, you're out there on your own. Multiple people are racing, but
yeah, so
you're all on your own.
The Rottnest Channel Swim is a iconic event in WA. They have about 2,500 participants, not all solos. There's about 300 odd solos that attempt to do it each year, and the rest are doing it in duos and teams. So it's a busy race. It thins out a bit in the middle, but very congested at the start and the finish. I don't think I would swim to Rottnest just on my own. I like the safety in numbers concept. As you may know, WA is also the shark attack capital of the world at the moment.
Oh, really?
So I think that I'm happy to be in the mix there. But it's a lovely swim. You can see the bottom the whole way, and it really is a stunning environment.
You've mentioned a few times how things were when you were first diagnosed, and the technical advances in things that are available to you to help you manage and monitor this. Perhaps you could just share a little bit about the change that you've seen over the years that you've been dealing with this.
When I was first diagnosed, It was obviously a blood glucose monitor. That's the only technology that was out then, and I used that for many years. Indeed, I still do when I take breaks from the Libre or CGM. And obviously that's evolved to continuous glucose monitoring and the Libre Flash glucose monitoring devices. I think both of them have been absolute game changers in type 1 diabetes care. Unfortunately, they're not as affordable as they need to be for the type 1 community. And that's something that they're certainly changing to a certain extent in Australia. They're now federally subsidized for people under 21, and fingers crossed that they subsidize them for adults as well. But the visibility of blood glucose levels is something that when we work with people at the family center, the lights go on. When they see the blood glucose surge that happens after they eat carbohydrate, it's instant. When I was diagnosed, and indeed even now the advice I still hear that people are told this, I was actively discouraged from testing my glucose after meals. I was told test before, so before breakfast, eat your breakfast, and then don't test again until before lunch. And of course, in the meantime, my blood glucose would have gone up to 15, 17, 20, and it would come back down very nicely into range, and I might be 5.6 before lunch. But meanwhile, I spent 3 hours with my blood sugar level out of range.
What was the reasoning for that then? It doesn't seem to make any sense. So you would have thought you'd need to know what was going on in
between. Well, the rationale would be, it's going to happen anyway, and if you know about it, you want to correct it with more insulin. Okay. And if you correct it with more insulin, you'll end up in a hypo because it's going to land in the safe range. It'll be all right. But obviously,
back to that linear equation again that doesn't exist.
Well, it just disregarded the 3 hours after every meal that I would spend outside of range. And if I didn't know about it, then I couldn't even act on it. And at that point, apart from reducing carbohydrate, I could change the time. I took my insulin, take it a little earlier so it married up with the carbohydrate curve, perhaps as a mitigating strategy. But I wasn't even given access to that information. And it took me becoming an overzealous blood glucose tester to the point where I had to have letters written by my doctor to the National Diabetes Services Scheme justifying why I needed so many blood glucose test strips because they thought I was selling them on the black market or something because I was doing 20 tests a day because I just needed to understand. So CGM now, people, it's visible. You know, we've got 288 glucose readings a day, and it's just sensational information. And I think that people really have the tools now to be able to act on that and change their management strategies to adapt their food and their insulin therapy to better manage diabetes. That's glucose monitoring technology. Obviously, insulin pumps have come a long way. I don't use one, but I see their benefits, particularly in children. Kids need that flexibility, I think, around being able to manage insulin and basal rates according to their very sporadic levels of activity. I think as adults, we can be a little bit more structured about activity choices. Whereas kids, I think, you know, type 1 diabetes already feels like a straitjacket. If they can run and play when they feel like running and playing and we can just drop their basal rates, I think that's fantastic. The other thing I think the benefit is micro bolusing. The pumps give the ability to bolus and indeed run basal rates at much more sensitively fine-tuned doses than you can get with a syringe or a pen. There are real benefits to the pump. That said, there are also the downside. Wearable technology has mechanical issues, you know, pump site failures, bubbles in the line, all the things that happen that come along with pumps that people need to think about, as does CGM. It's very intrusive. If you've got a phone or a device alarming at you all the time, especially if you're trying to run really tight thresholds, you will hear alarms often. It will interrupt your day and your sleep and your thinking. And that's one of the pieces that I think that we don't do very well in type 1 diabetes care is prepare people for the psychological burden of the wearable devices. The very act of wearing a piece of space junk, our kids call it, on their bodies and getting the questions and the curiosity from the community at large and have to explain diabetes over and over again, that can become a real drag. So there's light and shade around technology, and I think we have to be really careful in the way we talk about it, because in our diabetes community, pumps are almost incentivized. I hear this thing of when we get to the pump, like when we graduate to a pump.
This is the goal for everybody.
Yeah. And a pump is just a glorified insulin delivery device. You know, it might be snazzy, but it isn't going to change the fact that you're still making all the decisions. We do have closed loop technology is just starting to be released, which is really exciting. So that means a continuous glucose monitor is talking to the pump and automatically adjusting basal rates. The person still has to think, they still have to do meal announcements and exercise announcements. So they're actively managing those variables.
I think the tendency
variables.
Is to think that it's all just going to be automated and they can, the worry goes away because the responsibility is taken on by these interacting machines that are just going to manage it all for them.
Indeed, and that plays out both in the community at large. When people, every time there's a big news article, oh, closed loop technology, somebody rings me up and goes, they've got an artificial pancreas now, your problems are all solved. And, you know, that's absolutely not the case. And then within the type 1 community, when we see the research plays out, when you put people on pumps, their A1Cs in the first 12 months often go up. Because they themselves think, oh, I'm on a pump now, it's all automated. And so, and that's a bit of a hard reality when they realize, well, actually, I still have to do the inputs. I choose not to use a pump primarily because there are no pumps that are waterproof. So that's a little bit of a struggle for me, but also because I've found a really great regimen with the insulins that I use. And I feel like if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Interestingly, I have a retro thing going on with the insulin that I use. So when I was first diagnosed, there wasn't any rapid acting insulin. I was put onto regular human insulin, which is now considered so old school. You know, pharmacies don't stock it. When I asked my GP for it, he looked at me like I had grown a second head. You know, why do you want this old insulin? You know, obviously over the time I progressed to the newer analog insulins for a period of time there, but I've since come back to using the regular insulin in the last few years because it's remarkable in how the time action profile and the peak of our insulin marries up with the protein glucose spike that I get. So protein spikes my glucose after 4 to 5 hours, and that is exactly the time when R peaks. So it's really interesting that, you know, we can actually look to the older insulin technology and find it useful in this new way of eating.
That is interesting, yeah. I found it interesting as well what Jake Kushner was saying about how potentially these automated systems with the insulin pump, how it potentially could work particularly well if you were eating low carb because you had the blood glucose ranges were moving in a much tighter band.
Yes, and the increases are not as sharp. So if you're eating a mostly protein and fat-based diet, you'll have sort of these mild peaks, and that's something that the pump can keep up with. So that the pump can actually automatically adjust a basal rate rather than requiring a big bolus of insulin in order to keep up with that protein and fat curve. And I think that, I mean, that is really the ultimate hands-off diabetes management. I mean, you're not actually having to actively put meal announcements or food announcements into that pump, which is almost, I mean, I hate to say the word cure, but it certainly lightens that mental burden, which is one of the hardest things to bear with diabetes.
Yeah, so it feels like instead of having to do that micromanaging throughout the day, if you more macro manage, pun intended, I guess, with your overall diet and look at focusing on that, but that's not having to look at the details all the time. I can see that being quite freeing. Obviously, you've still got to carry on paying attention, but you're managing it with more broad brushstrokes, and maybe this technology and equipment could take care of those finer details.
Absolutely.
And just free you up a little bit more for day-to-day living.
That's the ultimate application for the closed loop system. And indeed, are you familiar with the We Are Not Waiting movement?
No.
The We Are Not Waiting movement created a technology initially called Night Scout. It's open source. It's created by citizen scientists, mums and dads of people with type 1 diabetes around kitchen tables around the world where they hacked continuous glucose monitors and firstly worked out a way to bounce the information to phones for remote monitoring. Awesome, especially for parents. The next step has been the development of the open artificial pancreas system and the loop system. So these are, again, hacked systems where people are essentially running the closed loop technology and have been for a number of years now, well before the companies have released it. I have a friend at home, Kyle Masterman, who is a sensational athlete, low carber, and he's running an open APS. And he has messaged me a number of times and says, I haven't given myself a bolus all week. And the system is just running in the background and managing things for, and it's giving him these micro boluses of insulin as he eats a big protein meal. You see the insulin start to catch up, and his blood sugar level is insanely good. The thing I think the system hasn't quite adapted to is exercise yet, and that's the next piece. But the idea that the food variable and the insulin variable can run in the background, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency, and we haven't spoken too much on that, but the tendency is just to look at food. But it sounds like looking at your activity level is
hugely important. I've worked out over years of experimentation that any exercise that spikes my heart rate over about 180 beats per minute is going to raise my blood sugar level. So I actually need to take insulin in order to do high intensity interval training or spin class or anything where I'm going to do sprints. That's so counterintuitive. I need insulin to exercise. Hang on a minute. The other thing that causes my blood sugar level to go up is glycolytic exercise like lifting. Then the opposite effect happens if I'm doing longer, slower endurance stuff. If I've got the formula and my basal insulin dose right, and keeping in mind that I inject that, you know, I'm committed for 16 to 18 hours of a certain activity level once I do that. So sometimes at 7 o'clock in the morning, I take a certain dose and I do a different activity than I anticipate in the evening. And sometimes you can get that wrong. But if I've got my basal conditions right, then my blood sugar level with endurance exercise normally stays stable. If I've got it wrong, sometimes it will drop off a little. So that seems to play out as a general assumption for most people with type 1, high intensity blood glucose spike, low intensity blood glucose stable or drop. And bringing that into play is really important, because when you're dosing insulin, you're not only dosing on what you're about to eat, you're also thinking, how much activity have I done in the last 3 to 24 hours? And how much activity do I anticipate doing probably in the next 3 to 8 hours? And so, as you say, you're bringing in another set of variables, the duration, the time and the intensity with activity, and another few variables if you want to really drill down into it that you have to consider.
Sounds like you have to be super organized and good at planning.
Absolutely. I think that that's something that diabetes has taught me. It's not my strong suit, but amongst a whole lot of other lessons, being a good planner. And I think almost to the extent where that for a while it took over my life about planning and routine. And I would become very anxious if my routine was interrupted, and starting to try and build a little bit more, I guess, being able to be a little bit more relaxed about changes to the plan has been, again, a more recent project.
Well, I could go on talking to you for hours. Oh. But we're being ushered and nagged by, interestingly enough, the room needs to be set up for exercise.
A movement session.
I like to round off the podcast with a top tip, which can be anything you like, but I think maybe it would be nice to give your top advice for somebody who's just been diagnosed with type 1.
Connect with community. Clinicians took me some of the way, the community took me the rest of the way. If you have access through online groups or face-to-face support, other people who are walking a mile in your shoes, the information exchange, the support and understanding that you will get is the key to not only understanding diabetes well, but making peace with diabetes. And I feel that community is transformative. It's absolutely essential.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure for me and really interesting. I've been fortunate enough to be able to interview a few of you who have type 1, are involved with type 1, and it's been very interesting and an education for me, and hopefully will be for the listeners as well. So thank you so much.
Thank
you, Daisy.
It's been
a great pleasure.
Thanks for taking an interest in people with type 1. It's important to us, and thank you to all your listeners for being interested also.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share, and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman, or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman podcast Instagram and Facebook pages and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from Ryan Blair. If it's important, you'll find a way. If it's not, you'll find an excuse. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.